Hello and welcome to another CG Garage. This is episode number 38, featuring Scott DeWitty and Alan Robles from Gensler. And we have Sean doing the intro with us today. Sean, do you know anything about Gensler?
I know that they are architecture.
That's right. They're a very large architecture firm. In fact, they're one of the biggest, if not the biggest, architecture firm in the world. Guess, okay, pop quiz. Scott, how many employees do you think that Gensler has?
Over 1,000.
Over 4,500 people.
I was way off.
Yeah. And how many offices around the world do you think they have?
Over 200. I feel like I'm on The Price is Right. My God.
That's a lot of offices. It's actually over 46 offices or more, but it's growing all the time, so they change, which is huge. I mean, they're really a bit everywhere. I mean, they do gigantic projects, and they've been doing a lot of amazing work. I loved talking to them because, believe it or not, that's where I started. I started working at Gensler. I actually have a lot of history at Gensler. I love the company. Uh-huh. For such a large company, it is amazingly warm and welcoming. And there's a lot of reasons for that, which we discuss as well. I've actually met Art Gensler several times and his son, David Gensler, and they're great. And we talk about them as well. I love the company. We talk a lot about technology, a lot about VR, cloud, ray tracing, all kinds of stuff. So for those of you who are architects or interested in what architects are doing, this is a really good podcast for you guys to listen to. All right, hope you enjoy it.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the chaos group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
About today.
I don't know. What do you want to talk about today?
Life. Life is good.
Yeah?
How was that talk?
It went well. We had actually a really decent crowd for it, too. It was good. And even Jeff had a decent crowd. He was worried that since he was only presenting for the first 5 minutes that he wasn't going to have anyone watching his thing. But there was already a decent crowd there and pretty much kept him the whole time. And everyone liked the building.
So Jeff Muddle was running it?
Yeah, Jeff Muddle. Yeah, he was showing off the new project Samoa that he's doing. I probably just butchered that name. It's the Restoration Bank of in England.
Okay.
Partnered up with HP, NVIDIA, Autodesk, and it's going to be sort of this like crowdsourcing BIM modeling of this old bank from old renderings and drawings that are essentially in a museum at this point. And you can sign up with Autodesk 360, download the plans, start modeling and collaborating with other people, and then there's going to be like a big rendering competition at AU for it.
So,
yeah.
That sounds pretty cool.
All
right. Well, that's pretty good. We'll start it off with that.
Okay.
And what was your part in that conversation?
Well, since Jeff only had about 5 minutes and didn't realize it was a 30-minute talk, Peter Dalat from NVIDIA and myself showed off the campus, the new NVIDIA campus, using iRay. So we fired up the cluster and the model and was spinning it around and talking about the design and the tech behind it. And
doing that stuff.
Yep. Yeah. So it was good.
I know Peter. And I know NVIDIA. NVIDIA, actually, they work with us quite a bit. So they're pretty cool.
Yeah, good bunch of group guys.
Yeah. Absolutely. One of the things that you follow the podcast, right?
I do.
You do? And we need to talk more about architecture. Obviously, there's a lot of VFX in the podcast.
Architecture is good. I mean, I like the visual effects too.
Yeah.
You know?
And you and I have known each other for a little bit, right?
Yeah, on and off. Yeah, a couple of years now. A
couple of years. And how long have you been at Gensler?
8 years.
8 years?
Yeah, 8 years come December, actually. Wow. So maybe more like 7.5 right now. But
And what about yourself? How long have you been at
Gensler? It'll be 9 years in January.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's like unheard of in visual effects. Like people for a company that's 9 years. It's just like, yeah.
Yeah, it's something. I got hired right out of school and didn't even know who Gensler was, honestly.
Really?
Mom was just getting on my case about getting a job, so a buddy of mine was like, well, we're hiring. I was like, great.
Yeah.
I get a job, and I got hired, and then it was my first day at the doing internal training for the first day, and we're Gensler. We have 38 offices around the world, which is now something like 46, something. I don't know. We lose track. We seem to open an office every quarter.
Right.
And I was just, my mind went, I was like, oh, what did I get myself into?
You know, right.
Got thrown in right off the get-go on a project for BP and just haven't really looked back since. And
yeah,
I had thought about switching careers and whatnot, but then just as I started working at this company, just more and more opportunities popped up. Got to go to Vegas for 8 months and designed two casinos in China. So, you know, that was fun. And then I just did 22 months in San Francisco for NVIDIA's campus. So,
right.
You know, that was a lot of fun too. So, you know, it's been a good company. They're great. They've given me a lot of opportunities. I've worked on a ton of projects and have seen a lot of things built, which is always cool when you do the renderings and they get to actually walk into the space and see it
yeah.
in real life. That's always something.
Yeah, yeah. It's I think the last big project that I did was the 2000 Avenue of the Stars.
Mm-hmm. All right, yeah.
And so I not only have been able to walk on the space, but it's in movies all the time now.
Yeah.
So you get to see it all the time. So it's like, I remember doing that. And we did an animation back with way back in the day on that thing. So, yeah.
It was with Gene?
With Gene and Mark Briggs, who was, you know, kind of a crazy guy. Still is a crazy guy. But yeah, it was awesome. It was a lot of fun. I remember that. I've always had fond memories of Gensler. It's always been a place like, you know, for a huge, huge company, because everyone's like, it's a big company, and it's it manages to put the success of the company and sort of share that back with the employees in an incredible way, so that everyone feels very much invested in its success.
Very much.
And I've always, you know, the way that they've done that is that basically every year they go up on a big board and they say, this is how much money we've made. This is where it's going. It's going to this. It's going to that. And a huge portion of that is going right back to you guys in bonuses and retirement.
Well, it is an employee-owned company, right?
Right.
And
but you feel that.
You do. You do.
And feel that. And so...
And as big as it is, you know, it's run as almost like a... like a collective, like a collaborative
right.
kind of organization, where it's a bunch of tiny businesses that work under one big umbrella,
and right.
there's that whole idea of a constellation of stars. You know, we're not like behind a big name.
Right.
Each one of us has the potential to kind of rise to kind of lead a project on a global scale.
Right,
and it happens all the time here.
Yeah, absolutely, and it is sort of like kind of. Like you said, you have the opportunity to do something, and you can sort of say, I'd like to sort of be involved in that or do something. And that can happen.
It can happen very easily.
Yeah.
Really, you just have to speak up, and leadership will go, okay, run with it.
Okay, yeah.
Sometimes it's a little show and tell first, but
yeah,
they're always open to new ideas here.
And they've kept themselves, as a company, they've kept themselves fairly, fairly balanced, so that when things are rough can ride that wave pretty well, so that it what happens is that it succeed more on the back end when things go back up, and it always it's pretty impressive, to be honest. I've seen some amazing things that I've done at the company. I've always been impressed, and it's like, oh wow, you worked at Gensler. I was like, yeah. Does art still come around every now and then?
Art still comes around, and at least when I was in San Francisco I'd bump into him occasionally. Still the nicest guy ever.
Yeah.
Just say hi to him in the morning, and he's so happy, and he's always just got a smile on his face.
Yep.
And he comes in and
he just released a book. He wrote a book, Arts Principles.
He did.
Really?
It's a really good book.
Really good book. It actually this year. Uh-huh. I mean, this year is our 50th anniversary.
Really?
Good note. Yeah, it is our 50th anniversary.
Oh man, that's awesome.
Yeah.
We're calling it 50 on is the branding, and we're going to be doing a
bunch of... It just reminded me that I was at Gensler when they had their 30th anniversary, so that's how long it's been.
That's right. The Houston office had its 40th anniversary 3 years ago now.
Wow.
We hit 40, and it was...
That's right.
It was something. I mean, we still have employees. If you remember Dean Strombaum, he's been there something 37, 38 years now with the company.
And, yep.
Yeah, it's just been, it's crazy how much that office has done.
Where's the office in Houston? Is it
still in Pennzoil?
Still in Pennzoil.
Yeah, you were probably in the other tower, but we switched towers in Pennzoil now.
Okay.
We have the 3rd, 4th, 6th, and 11th floor of the building now.
Third, fourth, sixth. So 11. Four floors.
It's essentially four floors. It's
when I was there, when I was there, it was 1.5 floors. And then they finally did 2 floors.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now it's 4 floors.
Yeah.
How many employees in Houston?
350-ish.
350-ish?
Wow. Yeah, give or take. I lose track. We talking about coming out of the downturn and going back up, we exponentially grew, like, unbelievably. And being in San Francisco for essentially 2 years, when I came back occasionally, I only know maybe a quarter of the office now. Like,
right.
People, I walk around, I'm like, do you work here? Like,
yeah.
And it's I'm finally getting back into the groove and, like, really starting to recognize faces there, but it's still so big. And it's funny. Some people see me and they're like, oh, hey, you're back from San Francisco. And I've been back for like 6 months now.
Right.
And I'm like, yeah, I've been back since March. And they're like, holy crap, I just haven't seen you.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's cool. I like I said, I've always liked it. And like you said, Art's an amazing guy. He's always been super friendly whenever I see him. Is David's still around too, right?
David retired.
He retired.
David Gensler retired.
He did. Yeah. So right now it's Andy Cohen and Dan Hoskins.
Yep. Yeah, they were kind of always leading it a little bit. And Andy's still based out of here, right?
He is.
Okay.
And Firmwide, leading Firmwide.
Oh, and Ken Sanders is now leading Firmwide.
Yes.
Ken Sanders?
Yes.
Ah, right.
So he's now overseeing all of Firmwide. He's transitioning into somewhat of David Gensler's role, because he was overseeing Firmwide, but I think they're sticking at 2 CEOs at the moment.
Yeah, no, I'm just from the three.
Yeah.
The three-legged stool.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
Yeah. Ken, I remember when Ken started at the company, he kind of started and he was super, super nice with me. I've always liked,
Ken's a great guy. He's my boss's boss. I work for Robert Plummer. Robert Plummer's my director.
So you're Firmwide as well.
I am. Yes.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. So I'm overseeing all of our, rendering technology, R&D into VR, AR, gaming engines, things of that nature.
Yeah.
And then just sort of doing, documentation for best practices with rendering and all that jazz, making sure everyone's sort of using the technology the best they can, you know, making sure things are getting streamlined. And
right.
We're looking into setting up a firm-wide rendering farm right now.
Really?
In the Amazon
finally?
Cloud. Yeah, finally. Yeah. Well, the tech is finally here, you know. Let me
tell you about the podcast I recorded just before this one. It's with a company called Atomic Fiction, and they did all of the rendering on the cloud.
Really?
Yes. So they just finished, wrapped up on a movie for Robert Zemeckis called The Walk, which is about, takes place in 1974. It's the French high wire person who crossed the World Trade Center.
I've seen the previews for that, actually.
So that's all CG. The buildings are, of course, all of New York, because they had to build New York from 1974.
Right.
So they build all of that in CG, obviously, and they rendered the entire thing on the Google Cloud.
Wow. How about that?
And so it's possible they have their own tool to make that happen. And if you're interested in cloud stuff with V-Ray, we have solutions for you as well.
Yeah,
we have our own product manager just for cloud and that kind of stuff as well.
That sounds entertaining.
Yes. Yeah. So yeah, it'd be great. Absolutely.
Yeah, we haven't quite settled on a solution. We're still in the early phases of trying to figure out the logistics, mainly being how do we pay for it?
Right.
With a company this size, trying to figure out where the money goes and monetize and making sure it gets back to the project, essentially. And,
sure.
You know,
and then you can, it's a billable thing, right?
It is. It would be, we would make it a billable service. It's just a matter of tracking and knowing who's using what for how long and where specifically that dollar amount goes.
Kevin, who's the sort of head of Atomic Fiction, he goes through the entire process of talking about the scalability of the cloud and how it scales up really well, but it also scales down really well because you're not using it. You don't want to pay for all these computers that are sitting there doing nothing, right? And getting old, right? So the cloud computers constantly update. And they'll have a 1,000 frame shot. Guess what? They'll put 1,000 computers on it.
Yeah. And that's essentially what we want to do. We've moved to a very mobile focus on a lot of our technology. We're building our own virtual desktop through Citrix, so anyone anywhere could essentially with a web browser log into a Gensler desktop and do whatever they need to do from their home computer or a tablet, or I can do my timesheet from my phone at the airport now if I need to, which is great. So we're moving to this very mobile, so we're not really buying desktops anymore. Few offices, they purchase their own render servers, but not really enough to cover the demands in the office. Like, this office has 550 plus people. And they have two render servers. And so there's always this trade-off of like, well, do we buy hardware? The laptops are, they've got 8 cores. And so for the most part, for really simple renderings, it gets the job done really well. But when you're starting into more high-end complex stuff, or even animations, it's like, well, how do we do that? And so having the ability to say, well, I have an animation that I need to render overnight. Let me fire up 1,000 machines on the cloud, and I'm going to come in the morning, and it's going to be done. And it's going to be $200. That's where we want to be, I think. And really, at that point, it's just figuring out how do we get that bill back, all the way back to the project on a company this scale. So,
yeah, but that seems like you guys do that all the time.
We do. And it's
you don't do it necessarily for rendering. It's just, but you do it for other things.
Yeah, and then that's going to be the other big hurdle. There's so many people who aren't used to paying for rendering. And I think that's where, I think probably cloud services are probably running into that hurdle already. It's like you're taking something that essentially seems free. Other than hardware costs, maintenance, and things of that. But to the end user,
they pay for the print of it, right? They pay to print for the render. So,
yeah. At this point, no one's really. Every time I hit go, that's not billing me, really.
Right.
So that'll be probably the one thing that we just have to convey and educate people. And again, kind of going back to the workflow process, making sure people are using proper settings and whatnot, not just cranking everything to 11.
Right.
And letting it
go.
Well,
they had a strict policy that, at Atomic Fiction, that they would render first, last, and middle frame, so they know that it's vetted before they just send out insane
renders. And so we'll probably need to put protocols like that in place and get PM approval and things of that nature.
But it's also, you can also use it for stills as well. You can use the cloud for stills, right? So some of the things I was seeing, Boris is our product manager for stuff. Mm-hmm. We can now add DR nodes on the fly. So while it's starting to render, you can say, all right, let me add 2 more machines, and those will pick up. And they pick up very quickly.
Yeah, that's a huge feature we're looking at finally.
So, and then we can do that. You want to do that? Let's add 25 more computers from Amazon right now, and then they'll go, and they'll start rendering.
We're going to have a lot of people taking advantage of that, I can tell you.
Well, one of the reasons you're going to need that is because of this stuff that we're looking at right here, which is the Gear VR, right? So you guys saw some of the stuff at our booth, right?
Yep.
Those images are 18K.
Yeah, you told me that, and I was like, that's... that'll never render anything 18K.
Well, maybe. Maybe you will. And the thing is, part of the reason that they rendered is the fact that Kevin had him on the GPU, right? So those were 25 minutes to render those images.
Nice.
So pretty good considering...
how many GPUs?
3.
Nice.
Yeah, okay. Basically just 3K6000s.
All right.
Yeah. But you could make them Titans, by the way.
You could.
Yeah. I mean, Titan X is actually, the Titan X is exactly the same speed as AM6000.
Yep.
It's hardware to hardware. It's the same exact GPU, and it's 1/5 the price.
Yep.
So I don't know why.
It's got to have the power supply to run 3 of them.
Yeah, you do have to have a very, that's the catch, is the power supply. You got to keep that in mind because it is. But the footprint on it is really small, right? Yep. And then you don't have to worry about having racks of CPUs either. Yep. So it actually works. So I don't know. I think there's a lot of things like locally, people really should be thinking about doing GPU stuff, and then cloud stuff, it doesn't matter. Just throw whatever computers you want on.
Well, what I'm looking forward to is taking these 360 renders, right?
Yeah.
And combining them with the video, right? And so you're rendering 360 degree frame by frame, right?
We already have that.
In a linear
pill. Oh. we can do that.
Did you see the Crimson Peak video that we showed?
No, I didn't get to see
it. Okay, so with the other thing basically does, he did 4K. It's 4K by 2K. So the problem with video is that you can't play video on a phone 18K.
Yeah.
Okay, and there's just nothing that can do that, right? So what they managed to do, they managed to be able to get them at 4K stereo. So it's 4K by 4K, right? Because it's 4K by 2K stereo. And they did the VR experience for the new Guillermo del Toro movie called Crimson Peak. So it's a horror film, right? and you're going inside of a house and you're looking around and shit happens, you know. Mm-hmm. It's like scare yourself because it's coming right at you, you know, as you can imagine. But it's really incredible. And so and they're able to do it. Not only did they make it work so you can see it on the Oculus, but you can see it on the Gear. Mm-hmm. And you can even download it and look at it on cardboard. So you can you can have it across the board.
Well, I've seen they did one for Marvel, the Avengers.
Yes.
Right? I've got that one.
Yeah.
But I'm looking for it towards our business.
Right.
Yep. So developing the workflows and developing the processes for us to be able to do it.
You know? But the thing is, there's still, we were talking about this just before, there's still sort of that mentality of getting ready to know what this is, right? Like their principals are having a hard time not necessarily saying, we got this new VR thing, right? It's hard for them to do that. That's not their language. It's not what they spend every day doing. But they know that it's a valuable experience that people can actually look at their buildings in that setting. So video is going to make it even harder because no one has even figured out what video is and how to actually make a video work in VR, how to edit it, how to do things. And I know it works because I've seen content out there, and some of the stuff that the guys at Legend VR are doing are really good, and a few other ones, Chris Milk did something as well. But it's a completely new language. Mm-hmm. And it's also a very dangerous language because people do get affected by it. People get nauseous. And the last thing you want to do is show someone their new building and having them throw up.
Right.
Yeah, we don't want that.
So there's ways of doing it. And I think that one of the solutions is not, no one knows what the real solution is, but one of the solutions is the teleport effect where you're looking around and you can go to here and there, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is basically a series of stills.
Yep. And that's what we're doing right currently.
Yeah.
It's like we're storyboarding the journey.
Yeah.
And each storyboard moment, each panel is actually, it's a panorama. It's 360. Right.
And, yeah. And it allows you to basically tell your story. And it's going to be hard to figure out what the value of it being in motion is going to be for the architect right now.
Well, I think one of the things these tools are letting us do is tell experience, the story of experience, a lot better.
Yes.
Because our traditional model is, okay, we're going to give you this still image, you know, this beautifully rendered, you know, single point perspective, or we're going to give you this pre-programmed fly through, right? And, mm-hmm. and you're going to look at exactly what it is we want you to look at.
Right.
What we're able to do now is to say, okay, this is not just what you're going to see, but this is what the experience could be like. And so through video game engines, adding things like sound and motion content within them and letting them be kind of self-determinant in their path of travel. But you know, again, now through kind of these more, 360-degree experience kind of fly-throughs,
yep,
where you're walking them through a hallway, mm-hmm. and that you could set the speed and that they, you know, maybe can modulate the speed so that they can slow down at places where they want to take a longer look,
sure.
or pause at those places. I think that's where we'd like to go with the transition from, you know, video fly-throughs through 360-degree immersive fly-throughs.
So I think what you are looking for is more of a complete real time, more than a 360, where you're able, instead of doing video VR, I'm thinking you probably need to have actual ability to just move around the space.
Yeah.
So, which is also possible. There's actually some guys called Neuralize. I don't know if you've heard of them. They apparently talk to Gensler, but like there's thousands of people.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, they do some really interesting things in terms of being able to see things in VR without having to go through a Unity or anything else. You basically just can have it in full 360 ability to walk around it and still not have to go through Unreal or Unity. And it's pretty incredible. I can't talk to you more about it, especially not on the podcast, but it basically makes it easy for people to just use the tools they already know how to use and just go ahead and make that happen. So the problem, though, is you can't really move around in VR too much unless you use something like the Vibe, right? Mm-hmm. Do you guys have one of those here?
We don't have a Vibe. I've demoed it, and it's amazing.
Yeah, we have one at the office, and it allows you to move around. Now, that gives you about 15 feet by 15 feet, right? Mm-hmm. And that's pretty cool, but it's still not quite enough to just walk around the space, right? What you really need is you need a motion tracking place where it's a complete blank space. You put the headset on, and you can walk around your entire office.
Yeah.
That would be the dream, right?
It would be, but yeah, there is that kind of spatial constraint, right?
But you'd basically, I'm saying, just make a big old open blank space.
Oh, we've got one.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, and it's just a case of, that big open blank space has to have some flexibility when we're talking about developing projects that are a million square feet.
Right.
How do we?
You're not going to walk around a million square feet.
You would think, right?
You'd be surprised.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that becomes a challenge. I think also these tools as visualization tools for clients and communicating kind of like, oh, okay, here you are standing in the middle of your reception and look, you can feel how high the ceilings are and you can get a sense for what that's going to feel like, in person. And
I think that's like one of the most valuable things. Seeing height.
Yes.
Yeah. You know?
Yeah.
Traditional still renderings don't show height correctly because you never know the lenses or whatever. But you can put this on, it's like, oh, that's how high that ceiling is.
Well, that and architects always like to correct for the distortion. And, and you just can't really, experience a 4-story or 5-story atrium properly in a rendering. You just can't.
No.
But once you do a 360 rendering and you put that headset on, it's like, okay, now I get this. Like,
yeah. Oh, that's what it's
like. Yeah, and we that's where we've seen a lot of success in doing those kinds of renderings, because that's when all of a sudden everyone's like, oh, I get what this feels like now.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, even without even adding audio or anything, it's like just that moment of, like, you do feel immersed in the space.
Well, how would you, okay, so you mentioned you wanted to try to create some more immersion, obviously, in the VR. That's the whole point of VR, right? How would you design sound for a space that's not built?
So we've actually talked to a few different parties that are developing 3D sound.
Yeah, no, right. I know about the 3D sound, but how do you, what's the design of the sound of a space that's not built?
Well, so if we're engaged to do the design of the experience,
yes,
and sound is part of that. So let's say it's like we were talking about a sales center earlier, right?
Oh, right, yeah.
So, a big part of that from the client's perspective was, we want to see how we can incorporate crowd noise and excitement to this thing.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you test for that other than, making physical mock-ups?
Well, right.
You could do it in a virtual space, right?
Okay.
You could pump that sound in. You could do it from a location. And if we're doing it in a video game environment, you could, experience that by kind of like walking around it and feeling that sound kind of change its origin as you're walking around.
So
it.
You could simulate sound.
Mm-hmm.
That'd be cool.
Yeah. I mean, I saw a product.
It'd be great to just go into a hallway, have the hats on, go, hello, and then you see if the echo, see if you can get the echo.
Well, I saw, there a 360 camera that had microphones built into it, something like 150 directional microphones built into it. And the combination of the camera and the microphones made it so that they could intersect the data and visually represent sound as it bounces off of all of the surfaces.
Wow.
Right? So you could see the room, and they could generate a sound in the room physically and record where that sound bounced off of and show it in the visual.
Wow.
And then if you can take that, same thinking, mm-hmm. and you can apply it to, they had it so it would be like a plug into Unity, essentially.
Right.
And you can get the same effect. You can generate the sound. The sound can refract off of all of those. All of those acoustics are worked into it.
Ah, that's pretty cool. That's really cool. Cool. What else did I want to talk to you guys about? Yes, Revit.
Yeah, Revit, yeah.
Yeah. So Revit was like kind of like this new thing when I was in architecture, and people were like,
it's a religion here now, pretty much.
Yeah. It's, and so Rivet is pretty much a parametric tool. So the idea is that it's you're building it in 3D from the beginning, mm-hmm. right? So you already have that, and then you guys don't want to necessarily have to leave that program, right?
I'm of the camp where I'm perfectly fine leaving that program, but there are quite a few designers that they feel extremely comfortable inside of Revit.
Inside of Revit, right.
Just having the notion of having to leave Revit doesn't, you know, they're good because they're in Revit, and that's
exactly
what they
know. Exactly.
And, it works for them.
Okay. You know? But having we've basically seen the new thing that we've announced of V-Ray for Revit, and I'm sure that you guys have been looking at that.
I've looked at it.
Yeah.
Quite a bit, yeah. And gave some feedback to Corey.
Okay.
On that. So yeah, I'm probably going to touch base with him next week when I finally get back into my office. And
he's actually going to be here next week.
In LA?
Yeah.
Oh, well then we should maybe set you guys up.
That'd be great.
Yeah. Well, he's going to be here next week. So because we have a big meeting. So yeah, I'll talk to him, or you should actually email him and let's say, hey, I heard you're going to be in LA. So, but yeah, he's a good guy. Obviously, he's been focused on the entire line of SketchUp and Rhino and mm-hmm. and Revit. So I'm sure that's been pretty.
Yeah,
exciting.
we interface with Corey quite a bit.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The thing about Revit that I've found interesting over the past, you know, 6-7 years is that when we started implementing it, you know, you would ask somebody if they thought that Revit was a good kind of schematic design tool, like mm-hmm. the ideation tool, and they'd say, no, you're crazy, that's no way. But now we're seeing, you know, as new people are coming up or coming in, they're perfectly comfortable doing that phase of design within
right.
Revit, which is, you know, it's a big change, you know.
Interesting. But there's still a lot of people using SketchUp, as
oh, yeah.
you said.
Oh, yeah. I'm one of those people.
Yeah, exactly. And Rhino as well? Do you guys use Rhino as well?
We use Rhino quite a bit.
Yeah?
Yep.
And then so how many people are using Max and doing renderings, or not as much?
Not nearly as much as there used to be.
Right.
You know, and thankfully Autodesk has been working really well on sort of lowering the so-called learning curve to 3D Studio Max.
Right.
And I've introduced it to quite a few new people who have picked it up and go, oh, this is nice. This is cool. There's a lot of power here and potential here.
Like, right.
Mm-hmm.
But architects are not necessarily, they're not necessarily technical people, right?
No. Well, it depends. It depends. It depends on the end user. There's
not necessarily. It's not part of their job requirement, right?
Well, you have to remember the three-legged stool here, right?
Right. No, I know. Yeah.
So one of those three legs is the technical part of it.
Sure.
And so, yeah, we have architects that are actually specifically dedicated to those technical aspects,
right.
But they're you know more prominent within the project journey at the CD stage and mm-hmm. the construction observation stage,
right?
Construction administration,
right. But they are very focused on, yes, like you said. But I found that it was very difficult when I was at Gensler way back when to actually get people who said, I'd love to do renderings. And they're like, great. And I would try to teach them, and they were just like, no, screw it. And they didn't want to do it. Some did. It took it, but it was like 1 in 10 or 1 in 20 that actually would follow through on doing it at the time. I'm sure that's changed now. There's a lot of young people that are coming in that already know how to do this right in school.
Well, there's that, and renderings have become almost like breathing at this point, where you just do them. It's not like
it's just part of what you do.
Yeah, it's no longer I need to do 3 renderings for this project. It's I am designing and rendering pretty much at the same time.
We've got clients that use our renderings as the design documentation, and then you can take the rendering, stand in the room, and have them side by side, and you're looking at a physical replication of the rendering.
Right.
Yeah.
Do you guys still use rendering companies as well, or
we do? Yeah, I mean, we do a lot internally. We do a lot externally.
Right.
Sort of depends on project timing, budget, client. There's a lot of factors to go in when outsourcing is brought in.
Right.
I used to just do renderings here at Gensler, and so usually at the point where I had too much to do is when we would start outsourcing, or
right.
we needed to do marketing material for the client. It was just easier for us to outsource that material
right.
because it was best to put me actually in the design process doing iterative renderings
right.
for the designers versus spending my 40 hours on one really, really pretty rendering where we can put that off
of course.
On someone else.
And, so. And then sometimes from a project management standpoint, you know, knowing that you're going to pay, you know, $2,000, $4,000, $6,000 for a rendering, mm-hmm. that amount is set. Right.
Right.
Whereas maybe if it was something that you were continually iterating internally, there was harder to kind of track and manage that.
Right.
But on the flip side too, depending on what you're iterating and how often you're doing it, the prices, if you set up your workflow properly, the prices of those iterations constantly go down.
Yeah. It was interesting. I met some guys yesterday, and they're ArcVis guys. They have their own ArcVis company, and they said, oh yeah, you guys put video, you know, V-Ray for Revit. You're gonna put us out of business. It's like, no, not at all. It's like, I just think you're just giving you guys a tool to basically render in another package.
Right? Pretty much, and that's between rendering natively in Revit, rendering in the cloud. There really is no other solution for those users who just stay in Revit. And
right.
Having V-Ray for Revit come into the play now, being able to have anyone sort of fire that up real quick, do a section cut, turn on the material overrides for just a white model, which we do all the time.
Right.
Is going to be really powerful. I mean, if it's essentially V-Ray in Revit, and some of the export features you guys are working in look really promising too, then if it needs to get handed off to someone else who needs to take it the extra mile.
Right? Yeah.
Because not everyone in Revit is going to be able to make the amazing, beautiful rendering that we always outsource to.
Sure.
Like, you know, that's the artistic talent that you just can't replicate.
Right.
Like, you're going to need those people all the time.
Right, right, right.
So it may actually make their lives a little easier in the end.
Sure.
Where now we're concentrating on assigning proper materials to objects.
Which right.
is usually a second thought in right. our pipeline, at least. A lot of people in Revit just... they're not assigning materials. It's just document modeling documentation, and then maybe doing 2D print to PDF type illustrations.
Right, right, right.
So in that case, you know, setting up materials properly and getting the pipeline set up, it may make the renderings a little easier to get off the ground and running for.
So
people
you
down
would
the line.
You would want like a library of materials probably.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. That's probably one of the few other things that is on my to-do list that I get asked for all the time. It's like, I just want metals. Can I just get a bunch of metals that I can just drop in here? And can I get some concrete, wood?
Yeah.
Other than that, the other materials, we do a lot of custom material picking on our projects. So there's no way to really replicate that unless you've got all of the vendors on board creating essentially 3D materials of all their specifications.
Okay.
Like, if Noel got on board and decided to do all their fabrics...
right.
In a material format that you could download, which would be great. Mm-hmm. That would make everyone's life a little easier. I mean, I always tell them, too, it's funny, when Revit started coming up, a lot of vendors didn't have 3D furniture models on their website. You really had to go hunt or buy them or model them yourself. And I would always get in sort of this conversation with someone. It's like, oh, I need a 3D model of your chair because we're doing this rendering for the company, we're looking at specifying your chair.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're like, oh, we don't have that. And I'm like, well, I'm looking at your brochure, and I know that's a rendering.
Yeah.
I do this for a living. That's a rendering. I know you have a 3D model of it somewhere. They're like, oh, well, we can't get that. And I go, okay, well, we're going to specify this chair instead in the renderings, and that's what the client's going to see, and that's probably what they're going to want. And then it was, oddly enough, about an hour later in my inbox, I would have a 3D model of that chair. I'm like, yeah, thank you. And nowadays, you can go to any one of their websites, and they've got all their technical specifications. You can download Max Revit. I mean,
it's all
smorgasbord of whatever format you're in.
Yeah, there you go.
You know, and I feel like that's the next step with materials. Like,
right.
That should probably be done with materials now.
Yep.
Because scanning in a material and then having to go into Photoshop and make sure it tiles properly and doing all that work is...
Have you heard about the scan materials that we're doing?
I have.
Okay.
Yeah. That's exciting.
Yeah. Because that's not just scanning. It's like proper effect. Yeah.
We did some of that on NVIDIA's project.
Yeah.
And that helped out quite a bit.
Yeah.
We were taking specified materials that the designers are making, and we were giving it to them, and they were scanning them and creating MDLs, and it was great.
Yeah. Like, yeah. And we support MDLs too now. So.
Yeah. That'll be huge.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, that's cool. I think that's going to change. I think that what happens what's interesting to me is the idea that rendering has changed. A rendering as part of the design process is different. And so that's the ArcVis, and that's one thing that we've been trying to clarify a lot in terms of the fact that ArcVis people are different from architects in general, because ArcVis people are making fantastic work out there, showcasing, you know, beautiful, and that has taken off to some crazy town right now, where they're showcasing full cities and they're selling, you know, condos or whatever they're doing. But it's amazing what they're doing, and that's looking absolutely incredible. But on the design side of things, renderings happen all the time, right?
All the time now.
And so renderings happen to the point where it's part of the design language and design process. So can you talk a little bit about how the mentality works? Like, what is it that people are looking at in the renderings? What has become the part in renderings that has made it invaluable to the design process?
I think visual fidelity and speed.
Really?
I mean, now it's become more and more accessible, and someone can be in their target platform, Rhino, SketchUp, Max, you name it, and they can create something quickly. Throw, and we do a lot of just white base renderings, just to, yep, you know. So they throw.
It's almost like a foam core model, right?
Yeah, most definitely. And we even have some people who take chipboard textures and put them on their renderings,
nice,
just to kind of start to mimic that
a little bit. Nostalgia.
Depth of field, and you know, yeah. And it's really easy just to create something, throw a material on it, and hit go, and
right,
see what you have. And it's throwing an HDR in there or just the sun and sky system real quick. And
right.
It's almost second nature now. Like, people are, anyone in any of those applications are doing it. Like,
yeah.
I watch our license servers during the day, and you know, it's just peaked max all the time.
Right.
Well, and it's because, you know, we don't work for ourselves, right? We work on behalf of our clients.
Sure.
And the shorter the leap that we require them to make from, you know, from us telling them about the concept and then them understanding, or us showing them our documentation, mm-hmm, and them getting what we're trying to, the shorter we can make that leap, the more effectively we can kind of deliver on what they're asking us to do, communicate,
sure,
our solution. And that's why the game engines are so huge for us at this point, or, mm, or these 360 immersion, immersive renderings are, because they're shortening that leap.
Right. Know?
They can get it.
So another thing that used to happen a lot was there was always a fear of rendering sometimes in the old days, where there's like when it would look too real too quickly, and people would say, oh no, and they thought that like you've already designed the whole thing, and then they're like, there's no going back, and they get upset, or it's like no.
Yeah, we actually don't run into that too much now.
Really?
I know exactly what you're talking about.
Right.
Sometimes I would be brought in way too early on a project. I'm like, are you sure you want a photograph rendering of this right now? And they're
right,
like, yeah. And then we do it, and exactly what happened, like, the client would freak out and be like, I didn't pick wood. I don't want wood, or
right,
I don't want this carpet.
Right.
Like, that doesn't happen, I think, as much, because early on in the design phase, I think the designers have gotten that mentality. It's like they haven't picked those materials, so they're just wanting the white model with glass,
right,
and maybe they want a concrete because they just know, man, I'm going to put concrete down here for,
right,
the moment, something to ground it. And a majority of our renderings start that way now, right?
So they've learned the language of when it's appropriate to do things and,
yes,
when how to do that.
Yeah, and the clients, you know, the clients have become accustomed to those as deliverables. You know,
yeah, the clients have gotten,
yeah,
more educated.
I mean, and then that's probably another reason why it's just now become second nature, because everyone kind of expects renderings.
Yeah,
like
sure.
There's no like, oh, I didn't get renderings, or mm-hmm, oh, I have to have rendering. It's just expected now. Like,
right,
I think everyone's been educated well enough in this day and age with images and, you know, Flickr and all that. You know, everyone taking pictures on their phone now, that images are just a part of life now. And
right,
so if I'm going to be paying you a lot of money to design something for me, I'm going to see pictures of it, because I know that's possible.
Right.
And then they use them as sales tools.
Yeah.
I mean, it's part of the business now in a big way.
Right, 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 right. Well, one of the things you were looking at when we were talking about just briefly on the gear was some of the stuff you've done for stadiums, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So you guys have a whole huge business now, business line of business, which is all sports and entertainment, right?
Yeah, Ron Turner, Jonathan Emmett.
Yeah.
You know, we designed the Farmers Field, that project that never really, I mean, we did the design, but never. And, you know, these tools, having those 360 renders are, you know, are letting us have a better chance at communicating to the client exactly what it is we're proposing, letting them kind of stand midfield and look around and see the placement of the scoreboards and understand how they're going to affect things like seat counts and sight lines. And then they can use them as sales tools as well. Like, this is the view from, you know, the private boxes, you know, the sky boxes, mm-hmm. and let you, you know, show essentially a view from each one, so that during the sales process they can say, look, this is going to be the view from your box.
And so much better to do it in a full 360 view of the skybox. Is like, this is what's going to be like to be here, as opposed to here's a rendering of what the skybox.
Exactly. Yeah. They can look at whatever they want to look at. They can, you know, as the project, goes along and different people buy those boxes, you upgrade the renderings with their branded content, right? And then, you know, the next company to come up gets to say, oh, look, I'm sitting across from, you know, next to whoever it is that they're interested in being mm-hmm. adjacent to. I mean, those things are powerful sales tools for our clients.
Absolutely. And I think that's going to be the big thing. All right. Last topic. What do you think the future is?
It's going to be... I have a good feeling that real-time ray tracing on a GPU and the game engines are going to clash at some point.
Okay.
I think we're going to get to the point where... we're going to get to the point where that tech is like, I'm going to be able to essentially play digital photographer inside of my application.
Right.
And I'm... As much as clicking render happens now, is like clicking the shutter on the camera.
Rendering is going to go away.
Yes.
The idea of rendering is going away. Did you see some of the stuff we did in terms of real-time motion capture on our side?
I did not, no.
Oh, I got to show you some stuff after this podcast. Okay. But yes, rendering is going to go away completely. And we are going to be able to do things at a ridiculous speed. On the filmmaking side of things, what Kevin wants is one of the guys I'm working with, and I'll show you the video, Kevin Margo. I've been working with him for almost a year and a half now on this short. He wants to make it so that he is filming his entire action and ray tracing it. Okay? So that's basically happening, is what we've been able to do. At least on the capture session, he knows exactly what it looks like. He knows exactly what it's going to be. It's not just some crappy OpenGL view anymore. It's ray tracing live, right? So we're able to ray trace at about 24 frames a second, basically.
Wow. There we go.
That's great.
So, but it takes a lot of computer power to do that mm-hmm. now, but it's possible. So now the computer power goes up, prices go down, whatever, eventually it's going to go away, right?
Yep.
And so ray tracing in that capacity is going to become pretty important. Now, I don't think it's going to replace game engines, because the problem is now those devices, in order for real time to happen and for you to really help, you still have to play at about 90 frames a second, right? 90, 120 frames a second. It's kind of crazy. So then it...
All right, almost a 4K resolution too.
Yeah, or bigger. Yeah. Yeah, Kevin actually rendered his short, the Construct short. He did the teaser for Doug Trumbull. Do you know who Doug Trumbull is? Doug Trumbull is the visual effects supervisor on 2001. He also was the visual effects supervisor on Blade Runner. So big name guy. He's been doing this for a long time. A
little bit.
Yeah. So he made a new spec for his theater, which is 4K, stereo, 120 frames a second. It's 40 times more data than an HD, standard HD. 40 times more.
What was the render time like on that?
Well, we were able to render it out in about a week using the NVIDIA cluster.
Nice. Yeah, I remember seeing you guys pop up on there when I was I was working on it too. Yeah.
Okay.
I was like, oh, hey, I wonder what Chaos Group's doing.
Yeah. So yeah, we've been using the cluster. That's so it's pretty cool. So I'll totally show you some of that. It'd be really, really cool.
Yeah, but, it'd be great.
So yeah, so you think that's the thing, right?
I think so, because, I mean, and I don't know, I don't think game engines are going to get replaced too much either, but just looking at what they're doing currently and what we're doing currently and what we want to do and what they're wanting to do and just how the level of lighting and materials are now and game engines becoming more physically and physically based with inclusion right. of like PBR textures yeah. and
yep.
you know real-time GI, it's only a matter of time, I feel like, before something collides where you've got a hybrid of maybe there's a real-time ray tracer in one of the game engines
right.
or it's rendering so fast in the game engine that you are able to get the proper ray tracing, and that's how video games look now.
Yeah, it's just still, I mean, there's still a lot of hacks that
there
to
are.
Happen, right?
There are.
You know, like I'm you know,
I mean, this is still probably years and years out, but
yeah.
it's I see a collision course, especially now at SIGGRAPH this year,
yeah,
and a lot of the talks and papers and VR, it's like this, the industry, all the industries seem to be moving in this direction.
Yeah. Absolutely, absolutely.
So it'll be interesting to see when it all comes together.
And right.
And for me, I think the most interesting thing is, you know, how right now there are plugins between applications to get the rendering done, to get, you know, this photorealism inside these from these models.
Sure.
Right. But those two processes are becoming closer and closer together where they're eventually going to become one.
Okay.
That you're going to be able to just switch the photorealism on or off within your drawing program.
Yeah. Yeah, I see what you mean. But I think I think there's going to be something that's going on. I think that I'm trying to start a new group, as I think I mentioned to you guys, which is in terms of our labs projects, it's focused on the design process. But I think that every time I talk to people, a lot of people are saying what you said, real time and VR, like that is the most obvious thing for architecture design, that like this was practically made for architects.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And everyone's trying to say, what is a movie in VR? It's like, screw the movie. This is about going a place that hasn't been built yet, right?
Yeah.
And that's exactly what it's for.
It's funny, like when VR was first popping up, some principals were approaching myself and a few others going, VR looks cool, but I don't know if we're not going to strap something to someone's head. And it's like, no, come here. And you put the device on it, and that's when the holy crap moment happened.
Right.
And it didn't matter what you were putting on someone's head now.
Yeah.
It was like, they were literally like, buy five of these right now.
Yeah.
Just do it. Like, here's the card.
And, yeah.
But then now we're struggling with, okay, so yeah, we've got the devices. Now, how are we using them within our workflows?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And also, there's a struggle also because, you know, the client doesn't necessarily able to take that away, right? You can't. So that's a problem,
yeah.
Or you force them to buy the device or whatever, and that's possible. But there's going to have to be, the thing is, with the exception of the Gear VR, which you actually can buy in a store, none of the other solutions are really something you buy in a store. They're development kits, right?
Yeah, not yet.
So there is no standard VR yet, and everyone's racing that way, and there's no standard, so it's a little bit crazy. But I think that the voice of the architect is one of the most important voices, and it's not the voice that you hear about a lot in terms of VR. A lot of people are talking about making movies or games.
Video games, yeah.
And it's not about the design process, and I think that's a real shame.
And what's really funny is that you get a lot of activity in games and movies on the fringe, right?
Sure.
The big studios, they're just like on a wait and see and maybe partnering with smaller concerns. Mm. For our business, you know, from the top of the top of the food chain all the way down,
right.
Everybody sees this as the next logical progression in our business,
mm-hmm.
right? Because we design places, and what would be more amazing than to be able to put a client in that place before a single brick is laid,
right?
Know, before foundations,
yeah, before even break ground,
before anything,
yeah.
And then to be able to use those tools as sales tools to be able to communicate to your audience and test things and to be able to raise money. I mean, those are super powerful, and our clients are realizing that. And so it's growing exponentially on a weekly basis,
right.
How many requests we get, how much interest we get. And you know, it's the education process. It's becoming really fun.
Right. That's cool. Really cool.
Yeah, we're having a lot of fun experimenting with it. And seeing where we can take it.
And then transitioning our work environment to support it.
Right.
Right? Because it's a very, very different thing to, I mean, it's not beyond reason to think that in the future you'll have people at their workstations, whatever they look like, because right now that's what we're trying to figure out. What are these workstations going to look like?
Sure.
But wearing the wearable, being inside their model and designing from inside their model versus clicking through a screen.
Yeah, exactly. It's true. And it would be great to render right into that thing.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
And that's not necessarily, that's not necessarily impossible either. So I'll just leave it at that. All right, guys. I'm going to let the last bucket drop because it's just about an hour, and I want to make sure I have enough time to show you some cool stuff.
Okay. Yeah.
Do that. All right, guys. Thanks so much for doing the podcast.
Thank you, Chris, for having us.